out will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big pecker. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we got one of my favorite guests, Phil Williams, who was the 1985 NPC Nationals winner and also the 1984 NPC USA winner. Phil had a short pro career. Phil is going to join us on the show again today. We're going to talk about a variety of different subjects. We didn't really talk about anything in particular. Of course, we talked about this coronavirus and how it's affecting him. Phil is out in California, and he trains at Gold's Gym in Venice, and they closed, I think, a couple of weeks ago already. I think they were one of the first ones to close. And we're also going to talk about his training back in the day, some of the training partners that Phil had at the Gold's Gym and also when he was in Sweden. And then we're going to talk about the coaching of today's bodybuilders. Samir Banood has been complaining about this a lot on his Facebook page, about how the current contest gurus are kind of messing up these physiques and they're not really focusing on what needs to be done as far as creating good bodies. So we got into a discussion of today's training and today's diet and also the drug usage compared to how they used to do it back in the 80s. Phil is always a good interview, so we're going to be going up to that in a minute. Before we get to that, I want to mention our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number, which is 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their website, flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They are out here in Tampa, Florida, but they will work with anybody in the continental United States. And if you mention that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, they will give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your order. And if you notice, Old School Labs is no longer with us. They are no longer supporting the podcast. So thank you to Florida Alternative Medicine for sticking with us during these difficult times. I also really want to thank our Patreon supporters. I've mentioned this before, but we have a Patreon link on my Bodybuilding Legends website, which is bodybuildinglegendsshow.com. And if you go on that website in the upper right-hand corner, there's a Patreon link. So Patreon is a service where you can contribute money to any causes or websites in our case, and just helps keep the cost down and keeps the show going. Actually, I want to mention these guys because they are supporting me every month and I really do appreciate it. Scott Barron, I think Scott was the first one on board. Robert Brown, Mark Johnson, James Kerr, and Harry Hayfield. So thanks to all you guys for your donations every month. I really, really do appreciate it. All right. Well, obviously, this coronavirus is affecting everybody around the world. It seems like it's changing every day, and it's just getting crazier and crazier, and who knows what the future holds. I think most gyms now have closed down throughout the United States. They closed out here in Florida last Friday, or out here in Tampa, I should say. The Powerhouse Gym Athletic Club, where I was training, was one of the few that were staying open when all the chain gyms, like UFIT and LA Fitness and all those other gyms, what's the other one, Crunch, they were all closing down. They closed down like a week before. But Powerhouse was still staying open, but then they did come in and they did shut them down. So the governor of Florida made an announcement on Friday that all gymnasiums, all fitness clubs had to shut down. So now all of us are going through the same thing. We have no place to work out. People are trying to get in their home workouts, and they're saying it's 2 weeks, but who knows? You know, it could last months. They don't really know what's going on with this virus. I think they're just trying to make sure people stay away from everybody so we can, as they say, flatten the curve and get the cases down so we don't have a huge medical problem like they do in Italy where they don't even have enough beds to treat people. And I think that's what they're really trying to avoid. as many of you know, I work full-time at a hospital. I do security full-time at a hospital. And we are like busier than ever as far as the security part goes, because we have to block all the entrances. We're limiting the amount of visitors that come in. So we're getting a lot of overtime in because it's just so crazy. Everything is so crazy right now. And also with your diet, if you're on a diet, I've got my John Hansen Fitness Challenge still going on. I think that goes on until April 13th. So we've got a few more weeks on that, and I'm working with everybody every week, and everyone's just having difficulty, you know, buying the food, and I'm having that difficulty too. I went to a store today out here in Tampa, Publix, wanted to get some bottled water, and they were limiting it to one gallon per person. So now I have to go to like all these different stores just to get enough water. Same thing with eggs, same thing with ground turkey. It's just everything is gone, and they're limiting the amount you can buy. So I got up early yesterday on Saturday, and I was just going around from store to door. I think I went to 5 stores just to see what I could get. And that's what you got to do now, because this is the world we live in, and they're limiting everything, and they don't want people to hoard the food. So it's really, really a crazy time. I've never experienced anything like this in my life, and I'm sure most of you haven't either. So hopefully we will get through it, but they're trying to find a solution to this, and they're just trying to prevent it from spreading and killing so many people. So it's really, really crazy. So we will try to keep the podcast going every week, give you guys a little distraction for an hour and a half or so every week, so you can listen to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have been trying to get some more guests. I'm supposed to talk to Francis Benfato tomorrow from France, and we're going to do a Skype interview. So I hope that goes through. I also am supposed to talk to Bill Dobbins. Bill was a famous photographer. He's done a lot with female bodybuilders or female physique athletes, and he's written a few books. I think he wrote a book with Arnold, in fact. I think they did Encyclopedia of Modern Bodybuilding. I think they did that together. So I'm sure I'll be asking Bill about that. I want to talk to him about his association with Arnold and how that was. Gary Bartlett, who was our guest a couple weeks ago, he gave me Jimmy Caruso's number. Now, Jimmy Caruso was a very famous photographer who worked for Weider. And he's from Canada. If you heard my interview with Roy Callender, Jimmy was Roy's coach when Roy was getting ready for the Mr. Universe back in 1977. And Jimmy is in his 90s now, but he's still around. And I'm going to try and reach him. Gary gave me his last number that he had for Jimmy. So I'm going to try and reach him and see if he'll do an interview. That would be awesome. I'm sure he's got some amazing stories in the history he has. And I was even in contact with Rick Wayne. I've been trying to get Rick Wayne on the show for, God, at least a year. Once I saw he was on Facebook, I started messaging him, but he never responded. And then he did respond once, and he told me to email him, and I emailed him, and he never answered. So I'll just keep trying. But Rick, again, would be another amazing interview. I used to love reading his articles in Muscle Builder magazine, and he was a great bodybuilder in his own right. Amazing physique, especially his arms. He goes way back to the very first Mr. Olympia contest in 1965. When he was in the, I think, Mr. Universe contest with Frank Zane. Rick would be a great, great interview. I'm sure he's got a lot of opinions. So hopefully, keep your fingers crossed, we will get him on the show. And also Robert Nalon. Robert is from Australia, and he did some great photos with Arnold back in Arnold's peak, when Arnold used to travel to Australia to do seminars and exhibitions. And he was really a good friend of Arnold, actually. I remember reading a lot of his articles where he would hang out with Arnold. So hopefully we will get Robert on the show too. So I'm pushing it and trying to get these interviews in. So keep your fingers crossed, and hopefully we will get those interviews in the next month and a half or so. I was supposed to have my bodybuilding seminar this weekend, and of course I had to cancel it because of what's going on with this coronavirus. I was really disappointed because I was really putting a lot into this. This was going to be my first 2-day bodybuilding seminar, but there was just too many cancellations, and we were down to one person. So. And then I'm glad I did anyways, because the governor of Florida closed the gym on Friday, so we wouldn't have had a place to go anyway. So I canceled it earlier in the week. Actually, I didn't cancel it. I just postponed it. So hopefully in the near future, as soon as we can, I'm thinking maybe the end of April, but it might be longer than that, we will do that bodybuilding seminar. Maybe we'll get some more people to join if we can get it going again. I'm even actually looking into doing maybe some remote seminars where they'll just be on the internet. Seems like that's going to be the wave of the future. So we'll try and do that. We did have some bad news as far as Chris Dickerson goes. I don't know how many of you heard this. I think this happened right after I recorded the show, the opening show for our show last week. but Chris had a heart attack, and I think he broke his hip. So this was on Bill Pearl's page on Facebook, and it was dated March 21st, which was this Saturday, was this last Saturday. And he says, I just received a message from my Facebook friend, Doug Curitan, who lives in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, regarding an update on Chris Dickerson. Chris has been on a ventilator in the ICU at Holy Cross Hospital since Friday, March 13th, a little over a week ago. They've made several attempts to bring him off it, but his heart is not strong enough. They called this morning on the 19th, and he is now in surgery to receive a pacemaker. Further information as of today, March 21st, said they also inserted a cardiac catheter, which should come out later today. Hopefully this will help his heart enough to get him breathing on his own. As of now, he is reported to be in stable condition. The hospital has asked that people do not call as they are overwhelmed with the coronavirus care needs. We are gratified that we've had over 46,000 responses since posting this information. I only wish we could let Chris know, and I'm sure it would make him stronger. So that is the latest on Chris Dickerson. We'll send our prayers out to Chris, 1982 Mr. Olympia, one of the greatest bodybuilders in the history of the sport, of course. And we've had him on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast a couple times. Great interview, great gentleman. And I know Chris is getting up there in age. I think he was born in 1939, so he's in his 80s now. Hopefully Chris will do good and well enough to get out of the hospital, and hopefully he didn't receive too much damage from this heart attack. So that's terrible news. But we're wishing our best for Chris Dickerson. All right, at the conclusion of our podcast today, I did get another article from my friend Pat Comer. This was from the March 1979 issue of Iron Man magazine. It's about Serge Nubre's training. So this should be really, really interesting. As you know, Serge Nubre trained very differently than most bodybuilders. He trained very light, very fast, a lot of sets. So it's not that long of an article, but it's very interesting. So thanks again, Pat Comer, for sending this out. And I'm going to read this article as soon as we finish our interview with Phil Williams. And Phil and I talked for quite a while, so we're going to have part one of our interview with Phil this week, and then next week we'll have part two of our interview with Phil Williams. So stay tuned for that article as soon as we finish our interview with Phil. All right, I think that is our opening. Here is our interview, part one of our interview with Phil Williams, where we talk about what's going on in the world today, and then we also talk about some of the old school training and diet that Phil did back at Gold's Gym in the 80s. Here we go. All right. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And this week we have another very special guest, my good friend Phil Williams, who has joined us a few times before. He's one of my favorite guests. And Phil was, of course, the 1985 MPC Nationals winner and the 1984 MPC USA winner. Phil, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me again.
So how you been, Phil? What's going on with this coronavirus thing, Phil? They got you guys out there in California. They got you on lockdown, huh?
Pretty much. It's sort of like martial law. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's not that bad. I mean, non-essentials out of operation. Things mm-hmm. like grocery stores, gas stations, of course. Convenience stores are open. I mean, you can go for a walk on the beach. You can go out.
There's oh, really?
A lot of people okay. out. Yeah, there's not a lot of traffic. Mm-hmm. It's not that bad, but at the same time, if you have to go to Costco, if you have to do some major shopping, shelves are empty. So it's funny. It's funny. Yeah. I've never seen anything like this before. And hey, they said this could be the beginning. It could get worse from here.
I know.
So I don't know. I take it one day at a time, one second at a time. Man, we don't know what's ahead of us. So, and living in LA, we have so many people. I mean, everybody's in panic mode.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What's it like there with you?
Well, pretty much normal for me. I mean, a lot of people are staying home, but I work at that hospital. I've been doing security at a hospital, and the governor finally closed all the gyms yesterday. So. Oh. But it's been kind of normal for me. I've just been not really stressing out about it and just kind of keeping a normal lifestyle. Some people are really kind of freaking out and, you know, saying, just stay at home. And, you know, I know when I posted on Facebook about my gym, like people were like, you guys should do the right thing and close down. And so, yeah, I don't really know. You know, it seems like it's changing every day. You know, you don't really know what's really happening.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't watch the news. I watch a little bit. because I want to stay informed. But if you watch too much of it, it's overwhelming.
Yeah, you know, for sure.
I mean, yeah. So, I mean, if you just take one day at a time, and that's all we can really do.
How's it been not working out, Phil? Because I know you guys were in a routine, you and your wife, where you were going to the gym every morning.
I mean, I'll say this, John. I don't mind missing workouts. I mean, I'm not a slave to it like I used to be. Mm-hmm. In the 70s and 80s, I was a slave. If I missed a workout, guilty conscience, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, now if I miss it, if I don't get up in time or I'm extremely fatigued, I take a day off. So I've taken months off at a time. So I'm not a slave.
Oh, really?
Training.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, you know, with high-intensity training, you almost have to.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the fact that this goes on for several months, it's no big deal. I mean, I'll pick it up where I left off once this is behind us.
Yeah.
So right now, I mean, we went to go gym on a Monday morning, and we got there. We drove in from the rear on Sunset, and my wife goes, oh, gym's closed. I said, oh, I looked in the back because we're coming from the back of the gym.
Right.
And I said, you're right. It is closed. And they had a sign on the door that said, and I posted this on Instagram, closed today starting at like 12 a.m. And they had no idea when they would reopen. Probably the 30th of March.
Okay.
That was the deadline for this thing. And now that's been extended until the 12th of April, I believe. I mean,
wow.
So what we did,
okay.
We went for a walk on the boardwalk. I mean, no big deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, I kind of suspected this was coming. You see it, you've seen it coming at a certain point.
Yeah.
But, I mean, disappointing at the same time. But, I mean, I hate to say this, between 12 and 4, they close at midnight, it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, between 12 and 4, you would think they have a cleaning crew to go in there and tidy up.
Yeah.
When it opens at 4 a.m. and you've been there at that time with me.
Yeah, right.
They have done nothing. The place is a mess. The toilets
are
a mess.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I hate to say this, but I'll tell you the truth. So, I mean, it's probably a good idea. I mean, gyms are the worst, right? When you think about
it. Yeah, for viruses, right? Or for, cleanliness.
If any virus is going to spread, it could spread the gym easier than it could outside a gym.
Mm-hmm.
Because of sweat, because of people handling equipment, people doing whatever they do in there. So, I mean, whatever needs to be done, whatever necessary, whatever means necessary to eradicate this thing.
You think they're doing the right thing, closing all these businesses and everything?
John, I don't know that much about it, to be honest with you. Maybe yes. I don't know for certain. You know, I when it first came about, I mean, I listened to it here and there. I didn't really take it in. I didn't. Mm-hmm. Who would have guessed?
Yeah.
I mean, who would have guessed it would have come to this? So.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So I don't know, John. I mean, I'm lost. I mean, I listen to what they say here and there. Kind of take it one day at a time. I mean, if I was getting ready for a show, I'd be out of my head. So imagine the guys that
know.
Arnold Classic and all these shows that are coming up.
Yeah.
Canceled.
Right.
And that's investment, and there's no return on that investment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big investment.
I know. I was
ready for shows.
I was going to go out to the Arnold Classic, and they did hold the contest for those guys. So at least they didn't waste all that training and everything. But I guess for the Arnold Australia, that got canceled. Those guys had nowhere to go, nothing to do. Right. And then the other Arnold, I think in Brazil, that one got canceled. And then all the local shows around here, and I think everywhere across the country, they're all getting canceled until May, I think.
Exactly. So they're saying if there's a gathering more than 10 people, you can't, it shouldn't happen, right? Cancel.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, we've never seen anything like this.
Mm-mm. Yeah, me and you are both in our 50s.
Sure. I'm 60 in June. I remember the AIDS virus.
Okay.
I remember the first guy in Stockholm who got AIDS in Sweden, documented AIDS, right? The first AIDS case.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like, oh, wow. I mean, we were like surprised, right? AIDS came from Sweden. You know, we were all in shock.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you had to actually, let's say, have some sexual contact with someone to get AIDS. It wasn't something that you could, if I sneezed and you're within 3 or 4 maybe feet of me, can you get the coronavirus when I have it? See, that's something we don't know.
Yeah.
We're not
I think that's how – yeah, right.
So it's hard to say, John.
Yeah.
I mean, I just – me and my wife went out yesterday. We went down to Manhattan Beach, went for a walk.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed fairly normal, except there weren't that many people around.
Yeah.
We went in a grocery store, did some shopping. It's down there. It seemed fine. It seems somewhat normal. But I mean,
yeah, I didn't know you guys could do that in California. I thought with, you know, like you said, it's like martial law. I thought you had to stay inside all the time. I thought you could.
No. I mean, for essential items that you need to shop for, essential, which means you know, food, of course, grocery stores are open, gas stations are open, convenience stores are open. I mean, for the most part, you can't go to a nightclub or a restaurant. Let's put it that way. Or a bar, or a movie theater, or a gym.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know. It's kind of weird. I mean, I'm not going to live in fear. Not that type of fear.
If it gets me,
it gets me. You know, I'm not going to, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to, it's not going to put me in a state of, you know, panic.
Yeah.
So I mean, we do what we have to do. Yeah, we do what we have to do, and we take care of business when we have to. We don't go out unnecessarily, of course. But until this thing passes, and how long can that be? We have no idea.
Yeah, Phil. I want to talk to you a little bit about Chris Dickerson. I don't know if you heard the news. I guess he just had a heart attack, and he's in intensive care. And
yeah,
I know you know Chris. You've worked with him before.
Yes. Yes. Where is Chris? Is he still in Florida?
He's out here in Florida. Yeah, he's still in Florida, yeah.
Okay. What city is he in? Do you know?
I think he's on the east side, like Fort Lauderdale area, right around there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I tell you some Chris Dickerson stories. Chris worked for the USA, and he helped me a lot.
Okay.
He never trained me, of course, not like one-on-one type training, but just advice. And he looked at me probably from about the April, May, June, July was the show, around that time. Now, he had a friend named Doug Ross. I don't know if you remember Doug Ross. He was a 2-time or 3-time Mr. Canada winner. And he was
Remember that guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Doug and I trained together before that show. And I also trained on and off with Ali Mala. Sometimes the three of us were trained together. You remember Ali, right?
Okay. Yep, I remember him well, yeah.
So, I mean, I spent a lot of time with Chris. Good guy, great guy. And I stole his music from the Nationals. I stole his music that he used at the 84 Olympia, right?
Right, I remember that, yeah. Yeah, right. Now, did Chris help you with that routine, Phil? Did he help you put that together?
Not a whole lot. I kind of made that up. I was a pretty good poser. Back then, I watched guys like McCauley. I watched Samir. I watched Robbie a little bit. So I watched a few guys and kind of learned on my own. Now, I posed in front of him, and he said, oh, put your hand, maybe do this, do that. But I developed a routine on my own.
Yeah.
And he kind of helped me, you know, get – put in the right position to hold the pose.
Okay.
And the right angles. And also probably the just a little bit of movement. But I did the posing routine basically on my own.
Okay. So, yeah, because I remember when you did the Universe in 85, I remember Chris was the commentator for ESPN. And when you came out, the guy said, yeah, you've worked with Phil. Or he said, I've worked with Phil before. And he was talking about your posing routine. So that's why I thought he helped you put that together, you know.
No, not the posing routine. I stole the song, of course, from him, from the 84 Olympia.
Right.
But I put the posing routine together myself.
Yeah, I remember he was talking about how the routine, the music was, like you used the whole song. And that was a few minutes, you know. And the other guy was saying, it's a long routine. And then Chris was saying, yeah, but when you have a good physique like Phil does and you draw the audience in, it's okay to do that, you know.
Right. I think I told you this before. I stretched it out just because I knew the end results were going to be me in second place. So I took my time.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I knew that. I had friends on the Swedish judging panel who told me after pre-judging that they put you in second place this is what they told me. This is the truth. He said they put you in second place intentionally. They gave you low. They scored your points low intentionally so Gromos would win. There's no way you can catch up. So I just said, okay, I'll make up for it during the posing round. And that was the truth.
Okay. Okay. But you said you were holding a little bit of water, too, right, at that show at the pre-judging?
Oh, pre-judging. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Actually, Samir gave me a diuretic, I believe.
Okay.
And I took the diuretic between pre-judging and the night show. And I was able to eliminate the excess water. So I looked better at the night show than I did at pre-judging, of course.
Yeah, right. And back then, they used to judge every round, right? They would judge the relaxed round, they would judge the mandatories, and then they judge the posing.
I believe so, yeah. Yeah, you had three rounds.
Yeah.
So that makes, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Mincer is the first one to get 100 points on each round. You remember
right,
that back in
right.
the, yeah.
78, yeah, so, yeah 78 universe.
78 universe. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, did you ever work out with Chris back then, Phil?
A little bit here and there, but not really. At that time, he had semi-retired.
Mm-hmm.
And that was after he won in 82. He moved, he stayed there for a year. I was there in 83 with him. And then I moved to Sweden, and I think he moved back to New York or he moved to Florida. But he left, he left California. And then he made a return in 84, and I think that was his last show.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just reading an article in an old magazine, and they were talking about the best posers in bodybuilding. And, of course, they were talking about Chris Dickerson. And some of the conversations I've had with Roger Schwab, Roger always mentions Ed Corney is one of the best posers, but he also puts Dickerson in there. People forget how good of a poser, you know, Dickerson was back then when it was really just bodybuilding posing before it got into any of the breakdancing moves or the stuff like Vince Taylor did or anything, when it was just posing. You know, Chris was really an expert at that.
No, great poser. Absolute great poser. I mean, I copied, like I said, from him, McCauley, Samir, a little bit from each of them and tried to develop my own style.
Hey, speaking of Samir, let's talk a little bit about, I don't know if you've been following Samir, but he's been on Facebook a lot, and he's always complaining about these bodybuilders today, you know, the look of bodybuilding today. And he says it should go back to the old school, and he's particularly talking about the posing, about the way these guys stand, and also I think basically about the symmetry and how we shouldn't have too much mass and how it's ruining the shape of bodybuilding. But he's also talking, I think, about a lot about contest gurus and about how a lot of these guys are showing up out of shape or even putting themselves in danger by some of the practices they're doing. And some people may not realize today, but back then in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, bodybuilders pretty much did it on their own. They didn't have coaches, right? I mean, you guys, everybody just did their own diet.
I mean, I pretty much, let's see, coming out of the 1977, my first show, 78, 79. I mean, I learned from a guy, Dave Washington, who was a great bodybuilder out of Kansas City, Missouri, or the state of Missouri. And he worked with, or he competed with Boyerko and Harold Poole. So he was the best in the area. And I was lucky to meet him as soon as I was introduced to bodybuilding. From there, he introduced me to George. And I learned from George the low-carb diet, you know, basically how to train. Now, how to use supplements, meaning steroids. And from there, I mean, I took that information, and in time I just stayed with it, and I didn't really have we never really had a coach, not with someone stand over you and say do this, or someone you could call on the phone and say do that, or we basically did our own work. You became I call this an expert at guessing yourself into shape, if that makes sense. I became an expert at guessing. So I was able to get in shape and win a lot of shows without any help or outside help or information. And I'd ask Samir, what do you think of this maybe? Or I'd ask Chris Dickerson, what do you think of that? He goes, well, maybe you carbs are too high, and or just little tidbits of information.
I mean,
we did our own work.
Yeah, so it seemed like, yeah, I mean, when you were doing those teenage shows, you probably learned what worked for you and what didn't, because by the time you got to like the USA and the Nationals, sure, you nailed it on both of those shows, you know.
Yeah, well, you semi knew what to do. I mean, you might have made a mistake here and there, but not bad enough to throw you out of it. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure I made mistakes and say, oh, that was too much. You did that. I went too low on carbs, did this or that. But I mean, still, it worked out.
Yeah.
At the end, it worked out. So, I mean, we kind of guessed ourselves into shape. But you had enough experience behind you. You had enough 5 years plus behind you to kind of figure out what to do.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever do a show, Phil, as a teenager where you were way off?
No. Well, the worst show I did as a teenager was the 79 Teenage America.
Like you just did now, something wrong and you just...
way off. Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was off. I was distracted. I had met a girlfriend that year, probably one of my mm-hmm. girlfriends, and ended up between beating Lee Haney in May at the Teenage Mr. Coaster USA, coming in first, and then mm-hmm. between March, I'd say May, June, July, August, September, probably not pushing as hard as I should have or dieting as hard.
Okay.
So I ended up being in fifth place at that show, and he ended up coming back from fourth at the Coastal USA and winning the Teenage America.
Wow, he only got fourth at the Coastal USA? I didn't know that.
Yeah, believe it or not, fourth place.
Wow.
Now, whatever he did between that period of time, boom, he exploded. And, mm-hmm. well, I didn't do as well as I hoped to.
But that was more because you were distracted from your girlfriend, not because you messed up on your diet or anything.
Yeah, I think so. I think I might have gotten sexually. First time, I'm stupid like that.
Right. That'll mess you up.
That's the truth. Oh, well, hey, I mean, but we're kids, though. At the same time, you know, I'm still a teenager.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just turned 19 years old that June, so.
Right.
But I made up for it at the Michigan Coastal USA in 1980, where at 19, mm-hmm. I won the overall. And I beat a lot of good bodybuilders at that point. So I kind of made up for it at that point. And in June that year, 1980, I turned 20.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. You won that Mr. Coastal USA, the open men's, and you were still a teenager.
Right, correct.
Yeah.
And Tony Little,
I just did an interview.
So you remember him.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, and
yeah, he's
another guy.
He's out here in Florida now.
Right. He was from Florida. He was Mr. Florida in, what, 1980?
Yeah.
If I remember correctly. Yeah. So the mm-hmm. same year. So actually at 19, I was pretty good.
Yeah.
I did pretty well at 19.
Right.
So I missed the Teenage America that year, going into the 1980. I think Mike Quinn may have won that year. I can't remember who won that year. I missed it by about 4 weeks.
Okay.
Four or five weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Mike won it in 81. I can't remember who won it in 1980.
Oh, 1980. I'm thinking, this would have been 1980. I can't remember either.
So by the time you got to when you were competing in the USA in 84 and the Nationals in 85, you knew then exactly how to diet, right? You knew, like, what kind of – how many carbs to eat, how long to diet for, and how to peak, right?
I mean, I had a base idea. I mean, it just mm-hmm. would have been perfect. But, yeah, I mean – this is the way I tell guys. I tell guys this. I said, you know your body. If anyone comes up to me and asks for help, I'm saying, okay, look, you have to know your body better than I do. You live in it, right? So, I mean, if you're paying attention and you're eating foods and you're kind of monitoring yourself and seeing what's happened in the mirror, and I don't go by the scale, of course, I go by the mirror.
Yeah.
And if I look in the mirror and I say, well, I'm getting smoother. Okay, I need to lower the carbs. I mean, so you kind of balance that out and try to figure it out that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this day and age, people would rather be told what to do, I think, than think for themselves. And I think this is what's happening.
Right. Well, I think that's the danger of having a contest prep coach from your very first show and then always having one every show you do. Like you said, do you really get a chance to know your own body? You know, I mean, do you know what diet works for you? Do you know what training works for you? Or you just have to rely on your coach? And then if you're changing coaches all the time, you're totally relying on them, and you really don't have any information for yourself.
Exactly. And you don't learn anything for yourself. You're not learning.
Right,
anything.
Right.
You're being told what to do.
So, yeah, I mean, exactly.
Yeah, I think that's what's happening right now.
Mm-hmm. When you were doing those shows too, Phil, there were weight classes there. You had to make the light heavyweight class. Did you have a hard time making the class, or were you kind of below the weight limit where it wasn't a concern?
Okay, let's see. In the AAU, we had height classes, right?
Right.
When you're a teenager. Now, once I left, went to Sweden, I competed as a light heavyweight in the Swedish Bodybuilding Federation European Open Championships, which is 1983. Okay. I won the light heavyweight in the overall. I think I was around 196 and a half.
Okay.
When I came back here at the NPC, I won the light heavyweight. Actually, my first NPC qualifier was the Amateur Grand Prix in 1984.
Okay.
Now, that was a week before the USA Championships, and it was a height class. So medium height. I don't remember the weight because they didn't weigh us.
Okay. I didn't know that was high class.
Yeah, in that particular show. But then I went to the USA a week later in San Jose, and I weighed in at 194, from what I remember, 194, let's say. And that's the show that, of course, I won the overall. I beat Labrada, who spilled over from one to 176 and a half to ended up at 178.
Okay.
And I beat him, and then Gary in the overall, Gary Strider.
Yeah.
Now, a year later, I go to the NPC Nationals. I weighed in at like 197 and a quarter,
which was
perfect. I'm pretty perfect.
Yeah.
Right? Okay,
yeah, right.
I beat Tommy in the light heavyweight. Labrada was the middleweight, and Ron Love was the heavyweight. So you won the overall. And then going to the World Championships, I actually spilled over to 199 and point something before the weigh-in and had to jog it off and do saunas and everything else. And I don't know if that threw me off. It probably did as far as the judging conditioning. But, I mean, traveling, you know, we didn't know a lot about – I wasn't very good at peak. You know, if I peak for one show, I'm done. To do it again 3 weeks later and hold on to that condition is a whole different story.
So, right.
I mean, that would probably have helped to have some advice on how to do that, but I didn't. I had no clue.
Yeah. Okay.
Did that make sense? So, I mean, I didn't know what I was doing, so I'm guessing again. I mean, but most of this was pretty good guesswork.
Yeah, yeah.
I guessed my way into every show, did it the best I could, kind of looked in and monitored myself in the mirror to see what kind of condition I was in, and then tried to figure out how to carve up without spilling over.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably did a better guessing job than most of the other guys did.
Right.
It wasn't close.
Right.
I mean, I did a better job of guessing than this guy and that guy.
Now you said carving up. Did you guys do, back then, did everybody pretty much follow the carb deplete, carb load the last week? Because I remember that was really popular in the 80s.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. I'd deplete for like 5 or 6 days, go down to zero carbs, of course. And then on a Wednesday, on a Wednesday, I'd have to introduce something like white rice, a few bananas, but slightly carving up. I mean, sort of like, you know, start low and then work my way up to the day of the show. I mean, that was really all we knew back then.
Yeah, I remember everybody did that. I remember they always talked about that in magazines. And, you know, this guy would say, this is how I did it. And I remember Lee Haney had a big article about how he did it. And it sounded like I tried it a few times, too, myself, competing in the 80s. And I remember one chill I did, I didn't limit my water enough when I was carving up that last 2 or 3 days before the show. And I ended up holding water. I got full, of course. After the carb depletion, I got full. But then I kind of blew it because I was holding way too much water. And I remember I looked better at the night show because I was starting to lose water after the prejudging. But for the prejudging, I really blew it and I was holding water. And I think I found out later. It was because I always heard that, you know, carbs have like so much water per gram or something. So I was thinking I need to drink water while I'm carving up. And I drank too much water and I ended up, you know, holding water for the show.
Ended up holding water. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And And the thing is, everybody's different. Everybody's metabolism is different.
Yeah. So
what works
yeah.
for you won't work for me or that guy or, you know, I mean, it's individual.
Yeah. Remember that Labrada told me that's why he ended up in the light heavyweight class at that 84 USA, because that's what he did when he did the carb up period, you know, the carb depletion, carb loading. He was drinking too much water during the carb loading.
Sure. Absolutely. That can happen.
Yeah.
And it takes years and years to learn your own body well enough. I mean, at the same time, I mean, that's, in my opinion, that's the only way to do it. I can help you with the training. I can help you with the mm-hmm. diet to some degree. But at the end, I mean, you have to know yourself in a sense. I can't guess yeah. you into shape, but that's what these coaches are doing. They're guessing.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know these guys. If you come to me, I don't know you. What am I going to do? I can tell you how to train. Maybe I can tell you how to diet. But at the same time, I don't know you. So, I mean, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's going on.
Yeah, I think one of the things Samir is kind of complaining about is a lot of these gurus or coaches are relying too much on steroid use. And they're just using the drugs to get the guys into shape. And it's not about the training as much, or it's not about the diet as much. So tell me a little bit about that, Phil. Like, how, as far as the drug use, what was it like back in the 80s, you know, when you were training at Gold's Gym in the mid-80s?
I can tell you it's very simple. I mean, I can tell you how simple it was. And I've said this before. I get ready for a show, I say 12 weeks out. I start my program. And if I could get what I needed, of course, and this is usually the basic, I could tell you what I did. I did 200 milligrams of test a week, 100 milligrams of Primo. If I could take fine Anavar, for example, I would take like 15 milligrams a day.
All right. Okay.
All right. That's 12 weeks out. Let's say 4 weeks before the show, I would drop the test, stay with the Anavar and the Primo. And I would ride that into the show.
Just Anavar and Primo, that's it.
Yeah, yeah. The test made you retain water, so I dropped the test. But that's saving your system for a certain period of time, so you still had it in you. And I mean, for the most part, I would take 10 milligrams, what was it, Novadex, right?
Okay.
A day until I dropped the test. And, I mean, that was basically my contest prep.
Wow.
That was it. I did that for the USA, the Nationals, and the Chicago Pro. It never changed.
Damn.
I didn't know what else
really?
To do. And I never wanted to ask anybody because I hated asking Samir. As close as we are, I didn't want to ask him. I didn't want to ask Chris, but that's all I've ever done. And there was an off season.
Okay. So
you would, after the show, you would come off for 4 months. If you felt it necessary, get on a little bit of test, a little bit of parabolin, maybe for a 12-week period, come off again after 8 weeks. And then come off again. It was sort of like after the show, you clean out.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember this correctly. And then if I needed a boost to train a little heavier, I'd use a little bit of test and maybe parabola for an 8 week period.
Okay.
Come off again. And then depending on when the next show was, you kind of timed it. You had to get the timing right, of course. But I mean, a lot of the time you were clean. You trained clean.
Right. So after the show was over, you'd be clean for 4 months, and then you'd maybe do an 8 week cycle in the off season, and then get off again for another. How long would you get off again after that 8 week cycle in the off season?
Oh, maybe 12 weeks. So we wanted to clean out the receptors. This is what we were taught. This is what we learned. You have to clean the receptors out. If you stayed on year round, the receptors wouldn't work anymore, and you'd be wasting the drugs.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah, that's what I always heard too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what we did.
Mm-hmm. So really, it was only like maybe two, maybe three cycles a year then, and a couple months off in between.
2 to 3, and at least 8 weeks off in between. 8, sometimes 12.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, That was it. I mean, plus you had the availability back then. I mean, plus the expense.
Yeah.
So I mean, it was, you know. That was all we thought was necessary. Plus, we had a fear we actually had a we had a fear meeting. We were afraid to overdo it.
You know, now, did everybody pretty much follow the same protocol, Phil, or were there some guys that pushed the envelope and did a little more?
I've heard guys on the East Coast. I mean, Bob Breskin, I used to talk to on the phone. I don't know if you remember Bob. He was a writer for MTI.
Sure.
He told me, he said, oh, the guys on the East Coast, I'm going to say Mihalyk's gym, are doing this. And we're thinking, oh, that's bullshit. Nobody can do that and get away with it. We're talking about 1,000 milligrams a week of test or just whatever, right? And we thought, oh, that's impossible. Yeah. We didn't believe it. So, I mean, so in a sense, we had respect and we feared it and we had respect for it.
Yeah.
I mean, I was making the gains that I thought I needed to, so I was happy with my progress. So I didn't felt a need to do any more than that was necessary, right?
Uh-huh, right. So Bob on the East Coast, Bob Gruskin, the guys he was coaching, he would push it. He would have them do a lot more.
Oh, a lot more. A lot more. I mean, and we thought, oh, he's full of shit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd tell another guy, and they go, oh, nobody's doing that. And they go, oh, I don't think so either. And we were that naive. We didn't know.
right.
But, I mean, we were making progress. So, I mean, I wasn't.
Yeah.
I was never a point where I stood still and didn't progress. So, I mean, I was never unsatisfied with my gains where I had to think that, oh, perhaps I should do more.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. And it's funny too, like when you talk about the East Coast and the West Coast, like I heard these guys on the East Coast doing this and, you know, this is way before the internet and computers and stuff. So that's how it was all like rumors and what you heard and well, I heard this guy, you know, so it's kind of funny how it was like the East Coast versus West Coast. And, you know, they're just, you hear about this guy and you hear about that guy. And that's how it was back then, though, you know,
everything. Is rumors. Yeah. Everything is rumors. And so, I mean, kind of hard to say. I mean, with the coaches today, I don't know what's going on. I mean, I'd like to help a few people train. More my knowledge in training and nutrition is more than it is with drugs, for example, steroid use. I mean, I don't have that much because I never use that much. So I don't have that much knowledge in that area.
So and it's probably different now, too, than it was.
Oh, completely changed. The guys come up to me and they say, well, what do you think of this drug? And I'm thinking, I've never heard of that one. Mm-hmm. And they look at me and go, what do you mean you never heard of this? I go, I've never heard of it. And there's things out there now that I'm not familiar with at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never seen GH, for example. I've never seen insulin.
Yeah,
I've never seen IGF-1. These things I've never seen.
Yeah. What Samir's talking about, too, is, you know, this emphasis today on size. And I think what he's trying to say is you don't need a lot of size to build a great physique. And like you were saying, you know, you would do this little cycle in the off season, but it was just to help your training, to, you know, to train a little heavier and stuff. But you didn't have this feeling like, I got to get up to 250. I got to get up to 260.
No,
like, you know, like you were pushing it. Like that's what I see nowadays. It's like, it's size at all costs. And they've lost sight of, you know, it's not about building a great physique as much as it's just size. And then when the contest comes down, you know, then we'll cut down and get as hard as possible using all these other different drugs and the diuretics and stuff. And I think they're losing sight of the symmetry and building the great, great physique, which should be the focal point of getting ready for a show, right?
Correct. I mean, we train for beauty, not just size, symmetry, shape. We train to be complete. I mean, and we also train for beauty. I mean, if you look at Frank Zane's physique, beautiful physique. If you look at Samir, beautiful physique. Robbie had a beautiful physique. I mean, they were tapered. I mean, they had conditioning, they had the symmetry, they had proportions, and they had, plus beauty, which is the word when's the last time you saw, this guy has a beautiful physique? It's hard to use that word anymore, the terminology, beauty.
Right. And that was bodybuilding back then. It was a beautiful physique. Yeah. But now it's like categories like, oh, well, he's got a beautiful physique. You should be in classic. And you're a mass monster, but then you should go on bodybuilding. You know, it's put guys in different categories instead of just trying to build a great physique overall, you know?
Right. Well, I guess they need to be categorized to some degree because,
I
don't know. Yeah. mean, I quit. I like classic physique, and there's a few guys there that are incredible.
Yeah,
and you look at bodybuilding sometimes. Yeah, and it's like, okay, he's huge, but oh, you know, it's hard to say, John. I don't follow it like I used to, of course. But I mean, it's changed, and they need to figure out. I don't know what they need to figure out in time, but they need to figure out how to. They've already had the categories, of course, but they need to figure something out. I don't know what needs to change. It's hard to say.
Yeah,
it's really hard to say. I like Bo Nax. Suzuki just won the Arnold. To me,
yeah,
I like to see him a little harder and a little sharper with more detail. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was great.
Yeah.
And you look at Rami, I mean, this guy has tremendous potential, but, I mean, he's a math monster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, I mean, yeah, it's hard to say. It's hard to judge. I think it's really hard to judge.
What do you think of Cedric McMillan's physique?
Oh, if he came in 110%, he'd be Mr. Olympia.
Yeah, I agree.
But every time I see him, it's sort of a disappointment. He looks like he's 85% shape, maybe 90%.
Yeah.
And he doesn't work with anyone, I hear, which is perhaps you need help at this point. I don't know what else I could, you know, I don't know. I wouldn't know what to suggest to him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he misses it, though. He's not 100%. If he comes in 110%, wow. Whatever he comes into, he'll win.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's got a great – I love his physique. I think he's got the – he's my favorite physique out of all the guys competing today.
One of my favorites.
Like you say.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he just never comes in with the right conditioning. And it seems like when he has a coach, he doesn't even listen to the coach. He kind of does what he wants to do.
That may be.
Mm-hmm.
That may be.
Hey, Phil, one of the guys who just passed away was David Paul, I believe, one of the Barbarian brothers.
Yeah, poor David.
You had to see those guys all the time when you first came out to Gold's, right, in the 80s.
Yeah, I used to drive them around. I had a car. This was back in 1989.
Oh, really?
Him and David and Peter both, I used to drive around. And I took David or Peter, I can't remember which, to Hollywood one time to get a suit. To get, you know, fitted for a suit, a dress suit.
Okay.
And I used to hang out with them back in the 80s, early 80s, like 81, early 82. Crazy guys, of course. I trained with them here and there, but I mean, they overtrained
mm-hmm.
to the point where it was too much for me. So I quit training mm-hmm. with them, and I started training with Ali Mala for the most part. But yeah, I mean, I used to see them in the gym all the time, and they'd be in there for hours on end. But I remember those two well. Yeah, that was a good time.
Yeah.
They were funny.
What was their training like, Phil? Because
just high volume. Extremely high volume.
Yeah. It's super strong, right? Too. Super heavy weight.
Oh, well, yeah. I can't train with them. You know, I couldn't train with them. They're too heavy. Too heavy for me, anyway. But yeah, they're very strong. Very strong.
And were they coming in like 6 days a week training every day?
Oh, yeah, every day. 6 days a week more than, I would say 6 days a week. And after that, they got into, they started, of course, being twins, they got noticed. So they started getting work in, I would say, Hollywood or just commercials or just whatever they did, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember both of them well. Funny guys. Used to hang out with them at Go's Gym at night. We'd all sit in front of the place. Zinkowski owned it. And yeah, I mean, cool. Even when Ken Sprague owned it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Good memories.
What was it like to train with them, Phil? Were they slapping each other around? Because I heard they would slap each other's heads.
Yeah, they do that. Yeah, they did that. I remember all that. I just sit back and just look and shake my head. No, they put on a show. They were showmen. So, yeah. And plus, they had got a lot of attention. Even back then, they were getting a lot of attention. People come in, want to take pictures of them. You know, film
really?
Them.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, by that time, they were already well known.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they had already got a lot of attention by that point.
So, where did they come from? Where were they born?
I want to say either Maine or Rhode Island.
Okay, East Coast. All right.
Or the Northeast Coast.
So when they came out to California, did they have an idea in mind that, hey, we're going to go out there and shake things up? We're going to wear, you know, construction boots and jeans and flannel shirts and go into the gym and slap each other around and lift these crazy weights? I mean, is that just the way they were, or did they kind of look at it as, you know, we're going to go out there and make a name for ourselves by being so different?
I think they were eccentric, and that's just the way they were. I don't think they planned it. I don't see how they could have planned it. Yeah. Yeah. I would say just the way they were. Plus, being twins, I mean, they kind of fed off each other. And they, called each other names and this and that. And I think they were having fun at the same time. If they were serious, they were having fun at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that they were two good showmen.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Yeah. Well, I don't think it was planned, though. I just think it happened.
Okay. Well, they made a few movies. I mean, they were doing pretty well for, for bodybuilders. You know, they're making a couple of mainstream movies. They made at least two or three of them, right?
Oh, DC Cab is one. I can't remember. They made a movie with, what was the black guy from Chicago? Is he from Chicago with the change? Mr. T.
Mr. T? Right? Yeah.
Did they make made movies with him? Yeah. So they did pretty well.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they did well. I mean, they did pretty good.
If they were out there in today's world with social media and stuff, they probably would have really been big, you know?
Oh, they'd have made it. Yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah. Yeah, of course.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Next week, we'll be back with part two of our interview with Phil Williams. And I hope you guys enjoyed that. I always enjoy talking to Phil. He's one of my favorite guests. I want to thank all our Patreon supporters again for supporting us on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And also thanks to Florida Alternative Medicine for your continued support. Now, without further ado, I want to read this article from the March 1979 issue of Iron Man magazine. This was the original Iron Man magazine published by Perry Radar, and it's about Serge Nubre's training, and it is written by Bruce Page. Bruce was a big contributor to Iron Man back in the day. It says, once again, in keeping with bringing top bodybuilders to the Toronto area, Ken Wheeler, owner and operator of the Vic Tanney Nautilus Gym, brought a world-renowned physique star to this area for the benefit of bodybuilding devotees to observe the methods of training used by this top muscle man. Although I had read considerable about Serge Nubre in various publications and seen many, many fine photos of him, I couldn't have picked a better time to bring Serge here because he is about a month away from a contest, so that he was training for that contest and working hard and seriously to get into the best shape possible. So I watched this man with much concern in order to find out how he attains such a great physique, both from a training aspect and also from his dietary habits. I realize that much has been written previously about Serge, but I hope that I can bring to readers a little more detail as to how he makes his type of training work so well for him. Serge began his workout with bench presses. He used a barbell weighing 220 pounds, and he performed about 15 sets of presses. He did not lock out at the top of the press, and he also did not alter the weight, but he used the same poundage throughout. After about 7 or 8 sets of bench presses, he began to alternate the presses with chins for the lats. On the chins, he pulls as high as possible and allows the arms to stretch right down before pulling up again. The reps for both exercises ran about 10 to 12. Following this, he went to pullovers for the lats, lying on a bench and doing a straight arm pullover. The arms were not totally straight, and they always had a slight bend at the elbow. For these, he used a 70-pound barbell, and he performed about 8 to 10 sets. The next exercise was flies for the pectorals, and for this movement, he used a pair of 40-pound dumbbells held with the arms slightly bent, and again, making about 10 sets. That finished the chest and lats, and now Serge moved to the shoulders. The first exercise was a form of dumbbell lateral, which he performs lying on the mat on his side. While on his right side, he takes a 25-pound dumbbell in the left hand, and he raises it from the front of his body up and back, sort of in an arc. He does not hold the weight at his side and raise it straight up to the side, as most bodybuilders do. After 10 or 12 reps, he rolls over onto his other side and he repeats the exercise with the opposite arm. His shoulder routine also includes standing laterals, which are performed with the arms going all the way up to the sides of his head and not just to shoulder height, and again with 25-pound dumbbells. Upright rowing is performed with a 70-pound barbell, and the press behind the neck he does with a 90-pound barbell. In most movements, he employs around 10 to 12 reps. With the shoulders well worked, Serge next began his arm work, and here he did the least of all. But when one views his great arm development, you wonder how he can attain that size and shape with so little arm work. He supersetted lying French press to the forehead with the standing barbell curl, and both movements were performed with a 70-pound barbell. He repeated the supersets for about 6 sets of each movement, and he followed this with 6 sets of concentration curls with a 35-pound dumbbell with the elbow held inside the thigh while seated. As you can see, he does less for the arms than for the other body parts, but there's a very good reason for this. When Serge trains, his arms are involved with everything he does, with the exception of legwork. Incidentally, he did not work his legs on this particular day. In this manner, his arms get a great deal of work before he does any direct arm exercises. You may have noticed the very moderate poundages that this bodybuilder handles. He does not believe in using heavy weights, and he told me that he's never used heavy weights, only perhaps some years ago when he was trying to see what he could bench press with, and he did succeed with 500 pounds. This proves that Serge is not a weak bodybuilder by any means, but he feels that he can build a large muscular physique without heavy weights, so why place all that stress upon the joints and muscles when moderate weights will do the trick? He does, though, use a great deal of concentration, and he makes the weight feel much heavier than it actually is. For example, when he curls with 70 pounds, he forces the weight with the muscles as though it were much heavier than that. His mind also concentrates as though it were a heavy weight, and in this way, he gets as much or more out of the exercise as would a person handling a heavy weight where he has to use the shoulders and back and probably legs in order to curl the weight. When Serge curls, only his biceps work fully and not a number of accessory muscles. And so this is the principle he employs in all the exercises. He told me the most he uses for squats is 250 pounds. Not a great deal of weight, is it? Another interesting aspect of Serge's training is that he doesn't start out to do a certain number of sets in a given movement, but rather he times each body part. He wears his watch during his workout, and he gives each muscle group a certain time limit. He also goes by how the muscle feels after a certain time. If within that time limit set for a muscle group, that muscle group feels satisfactorily pumped, then he stops and he goes on to the next. He also appears to take longer rest periods between sets than most top bodybuilders, at least a full minute and sometimes longer. This does not seem to adversely affect his pump, and yet he rests considerably more than most bodybuilders. From a nutrition standpoint, Serge normally eats almost anything except sugar, which he avoids like the plague. In this respect, he's a smart man because sugar is a poison, and there is no doubt about that. He eats a lot of carbohydrates between contests, and he enjoys all kinds of food. However, when he begins to train for a contest, there is a gradual cutback in carbs and an increase in protein. And by the time he gets to within a month of the contest, he is down to zero carbs and all protein. And to Serge, this means meat and fish. Since he's about a month away from a contest at this writing, Serge is on a protein, no-carb diet, and he weighs 218 pounds in beautiful shape. He posed for the crowd, and the response was thunderous. Such a tiny waist and large muscular arms, shoulders, chest, etc. He is incredible to view on the posing dais, and to think he does all this without using heavy weights. As for steroids, yes, he has used them, but now only a month prior to a contest, and he takes the injectable once every 10 days. Incidentally, I found it most interesting when Serge told me he had a 20-inch arm before he ever heard of steroids. So it can be done without drugs, fellows. I found Serge Nabre to be one of the finest people I've met to date, besides one of the very best developed, and I hope he will honor us with a return visit in the not-too-distant future. All right, great article. Serge Nabre, one of the greatest physiques ever, and of course we all know that he did train like that. He trained very, very light, very fast, a lot of volume, and just concentrated real heavily. So great article. Thanks to Pat Comer for sending that. And again, thanks to Florida Alternative Medicine for sponsoring our show. We will be back next week with part two of our interview with Phil Williams. Until then, stay safe, everybody. Try to avoid people. Try to avoid getting sick. Keep your immune system up. If you can get your training in, I hope you can get your training in. I hope you continue eating right. And let's just try to weather the storm and get through it. All right, everyone. See you guys next week. Take care.